ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about why a plant-based diet is the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Today we feature a conversation with Dr. Melanie Joy, who's the founder and president of the Carnism Awareness and Action Network. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
The Animal Legal Defense Fund and Center for Food Safety are applauding Russia's ban on U.S. beef and pork products because the meats may include a feed additive known as ractopamine. In December 2012, the two groups jointly filed a petition with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, calling for the immediate review, study, and reduction of the allowable levels of ractopamine, a controversial animal feed additive that is widely used in industrial factory farms and raises significant food safety and animal welfare concerns for the U.S. meat industry. The joint petition urges the FDA to conduct comprehensive studies on the long-term effects on human consumption, immediate health impacts on animals, environmental impacts, and a thorough review of international standards. Ractopamine, which is used to accelerate weight gain and promote feed efficiency and leanness in animals raised for meat, has been criticized in evidence collected by the FDA and the European Food Safety Authority. The drug is linked with significant health problems in animals, including cardiovascular stress, musculoskeletal tremors, increased aggression, and hyperactivity. Furthermore, the U.S. is the only country unable to guarantee that pork and beef products shipped to Russia would be free of the additive. A new report by the research and testing publication Consumer Reports, investigating 240 U.S. pork products for ractopamine, found that 1 in 5 products tested positive for ractopamine residue. You can learn more about this petition at aldf.org.
The January issue of the Journal of Disorders featured an article on tomatoes. Japanese researchers in the Department of Epidemiology at Tianjin Medical University found that the lycopene in tomatoes reduced symptoms of depression. They tested vegetable intake in a group of elderly subjects and concluded, "This study demonstrated that a tomato-rich diet is independently related to lower prevalence of depressive symptoms." These results suggest that a tomato-rich diet may have a beneficial effect on the prevention of depressive symptoms. Actually, there is more lycopene in watermelon than in tomatoes. Watermelon is packed full of nutrition. It hydrates and it's low fat. Watermelons are an excellent source of several vitamins: vitamin A, which helps maintain eye health and is an antioxidant; vitamin C, which helps strengthen immunity, heal wounds, and prevent cell damage; vitamin B6, which helps brain function and helps convert protein to energy. Tomatoes have been highly touted as a great source of lycopene, a powerful antioxidant that helps fight heart disease and several types of cancer, prostate cancer in particular. Watermelon, however, has the highest concentration of lycopene of any fresh fruit or vegetable. It's a great source of potassium, which helps muscle and nerve function, helps maintain the body's proper electrolyte and acid-base balance, and helps lower the risk of high blood pressure. Scientists are always finding new benefits of fruit and vegetables, but they never seem to find anything good about animal products. Be sure to include watermelon and tomatoes in a healthy plant-based diet. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Dr. Melanie Joy, a Harvard-educated psychologist and professor of psychology and sociology at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and author of the award-winning book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. Dr. Joy is also founder and president of the Carnism Awareness and Action Network. Stay with us. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Dr. Melanie Joy. Thanks for being back with us again, Melanie.
Oh, hi. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
So I'm a follower of yours on Facebook, and I have read with interest your tour of the world. Tell us about what you've been doing lately, speaking in other countries.
Oh, it's just been 2012 has just been a phenomenal year for Carnism Awareness. My organization is Carnism Awareness and Action Network, or CAN, and we went in, 2011 we were an organization of me and one assistant, and now we're a team of nine really committed individuals. And 2012 was just phenomenal. I gave 53 talks in 12 countries and 33 cities around the world. National press in just about all of the European countries I spoke in. And there was just, I've been giving my Carnism presentation, which is a presentation about the invisible system, belief system that conditions us to eat animals, that I call Carnism. And I've been giving this around the world. And there's just been such a phenomenal, overwhelmingly positive response. In fact, there are so many people now around the world that are really actively writing and speaking and publishing about Carnism that we're actually in the process of launching CAN Europe, and we'll branch over there. So it's been very, very exciting to see what's happening and how this has really taken on a life of its own. And in 2013, we already have plans. You know, it looks like I'll be speaking in four continents. And CAN Europe will really be expanding itself over then. There are a lot of other exciting projects that we'll announce in our first newsletter that will be out in February. But the reason that I mention all of this and what makes it so exciting is that this outpouring of support and interest, this incredible positive response to the Carnism presentation, it demonstrates precisely what I wrote about in my article, which is, all around the world, people are open and they're interested in this idea and these questions about, why do we eat some animals and not others, and that people really care. People really care about animals, and they really care about the truth. And it also demonstrates that the world is ready for the kind of change that, those of us who are animal advocates and vegan and vegetarian advocates are demanding. And it's changing rather quickly. This momentum, the growth of the vegan movement around the world is undeniable, and there are no signs of it slowing.
Well, speaking of truth, Melanie, your new article, Speaking Truth to Power, Understanding the Dominant Animal Eating Narrative for Vegan Empowerment and Social Transformation, you start by talking about how, history is shaped by stories. What's the story? I mean, what's the dominant, narrative now in terms of our society and our food choices?
Well, let me just qualify that a little bit, and that's a great question. I mean, if we think about history is shaped by stories, because beneath every oppression and every revolution are really narratives or stories that guide it. So, for instance, we can't invade and take up arms against another without first believing the story that the other is our enemy who must be conquered. Just like we can't stand together in protest of violent invasions without believing the story that the war is unjust. So stories really guide, they shape our reality, they define our reality, they shape our thoughts and our feelings and very much guide our behaviors. There are lots of different types of stories, and you asked about the dominant stories or the dominant narratives. And dominant narratives are the stories that are told by the dominant culture. They define our reality, they guide our lives like an invisible hand. And when the dominant culture is also oppressive, then its narratives or its stories are oppressive. And in this sense, these narratives are fictions. They're stories that are constructed to delude people into supporting the dominant way of life, even though that way of life runs counter to what they would otherwise support. And the dominant narratives are also constructed to silence the voices of people who seek to tell the truth, who seek to speak truth to power.
It just seems so obvious to me that some of these stories are fictional, and I don't understand why because people they want to know the truth. How can they be so misled by animal agriculture, for example?
That's a great question. What I'd like to do is to just give a quick example of a case study of feminism so that it's really clear about how stories impact, the impact of stories and the lessons to be learned from history and stories told. If we think about the third wave feminist movement in the 1970s, we can see that it evolved through telling truthful stories that challenged the dominant fictions of the culture. because throughout much of the 20th century, women were considered inferior to men and therefore destined for a life of domestic servitude. And women typically didn't rebel against this. They just obligingly submitted to their fate. But in the 1960s, women started talking with one another and sharing their stories with one another, and these conversations eventually led to the establishment of formal discussion groups. And as more and more women shared their stories, they recognized that many of them were having the very same problems, such as being abused by their husbands. And what they recognized through sharing their own stories was that they were not inferior. They were oppressed. And this was a significant shift in consciousness that actually helped launch the women's liberation movement, which was to change the course of history. Now, the lessons of this story are significant for any of us who seek social transformation. One is that stories shape our lives and our world for better or worse. When women believed the stories of the sexist culture, they believed that it was their own personal deficiencies rather than external power structures that were to blame for their lower social status. Another lesson is that, as I've said, stories can be fiction or fact. The dominant story of sexist culture was that women were inferior, but this was based on gross distortions of the truth about women's nature and experience. Another lesson is that widespread stories reflect and reinforce a widespread ideology or belief system. This story that women were inferior to men didn't exist in a vacuum. It reflected the widespread ideology of sexism. And finally, when we change our stories, we change our lives and our world. And you asked me about the dominant animal eating narrative and to story. And to really understand that, we have to understand what the dominant ideology is that breeds this narrative. And I mentioned this briefly, but it's what I refer to as carnism, which is the invisible belief system that conditions us to eat certain animals. And, you know, carnism is... it's a dominant ideology. That means it's invisible, and it's woven through the very structure of society to shape norms, laws, beliefs, behaviors, etc. And it also becomes internalized to shape the very way we think and feel about eating animals. And carnism is also an oppressive ideology. It's organized around violence and oppression of animals. And meat cannot be procured without killing. And so carnism is really a system of oppression, and ideologies such as carnism need to use a set of social and psychological defense mechanisms to enable humane people to participate in inhumane practices without fully realizing what they are doing. In other words, carnism teaches us how not to think and feel when it comes to eating animals. And these defense mechanisms exist. What they do is they tell stories. They create fictions to delude people into supporting the dominant way of life when they would very likely choose not to support that way of life if they weren't being influenced by the stories of the dominant culture.
Melanie, that's one of the main things I seem to see in carnists is I don't want to see those pictures. I don't want to hear about the animals and the way they're treated. They just turn a blind eye to the facts.
What I have found, anyway, is that many people do want to know the truth, and they are open to the truth. But people are also conditioned by this dominant system that makes it, in some ways, difficult to witness the truth. And as vegan advocates, you know, our goal is to, you know, replace fictions with facts. And often what we want to do is to tell people, you know, the truth with a capital T. And we assume when people get the truth about eating animals, they'll never want to eat animals again. But in reality, witnessing the truth about carnism is difficult to do for many people. It can be traumatizing. There's a way in which this information needs to be presented so that it's safe for people to take in the truth about eating animals. And, you know, the ideology is constructed to keep us asleep, to make it just so much easier to follow the path of least resistance and to stay comfortably numb. I always say that the asking somebody to stop eating animals is not simply asking for a shift of behavior. It's asking for a shift of consciousness, and that kind of shift of consciousness does not come about until a person is ready to make the change. So, you know, those of us who want to speak truth to power, to raise awareness about the truth of what's happening to the animals, the truth of what's happening to people who eat animals, the truth of what's happening to our planet because of animal agriculture, the truth about carnism, you know, we also have a responsibility to present this information in a way that increases the likelihood that it will be received and people will not feel attacked by it. As the culture is so defended, these defenses are internalized, and it makes it a tricky, you know, we have to kind of walk a fine line when we're doing that.
So what is the way? How do we present this so that we're not offending or asking someone to change their entire belief system overnight?
Well, I think one thing that's very, very important for vegans to recognize, first and foremost, what's very important is to recognize that we are all enmeshed in this system together. We are all enmeshed in the system that is carnism. And carnism is a system of victimization. It victimizes all of us in different ways. You know, clearly farmed animals are the most obvious and direct victims of the system. But, you know, there are many victims of the system, including vegans, which is what my article is about, the vegan casualties of carnism, and those who consume animals, whose very preferences, thoughts, and feelings have been manipulated by a system that's outside of their awareness and therefore outside of their control. If we can recognize that people who eat animals are influenced by a system, then we can recognize that the real problem or the core problem is not the individual, that good people participate in harmful practices without being bad people, and that the real problem is the system. For vegans to do this, however, it's very important for us as a group to step outside of the system as much as possible. In my article, Speaking Truth to Power, I talk about two types of carnistic defenses, primary defenses, which distort all defenses, seek, you know, to tell stories, fictions that distort the truth, distort reality. Primary defenses distort the truth about farmed animals. For instance, they teach us to think of farmed animals as objects, as things, and they distort the truth about people who eat animals, proponents of carnism. For example, they make us believe that eating animals is the right thing to do. It's normal, natural, and necessary. Many vegans and vegetarians have recognized primary carnistic defenses, which is why much of our advocacy is organized around challenging these defenses. We have campaigns, for instance, to challenge primary carnistic denial, denying that there's a problem, to make the invisible visible. We have medical practitioners and nutritional practitioners, you know, demonstrating, debunking what I call the three ends of justification, eating animals as normal, natural, and necessary, and providing literature that demonstrates the dangers and the consequences of eating animals on one's physical well-being, one's body. We have campaigns demonstrating, for example, the individuality of farmed animals to show that they're not a pig is a pig and all pigs are the same is a myth. It's a carnistic myth. So many vegans recognize these primary carnistic defenses and have stepped outside of that part of the system. But if we imagine carnistic defenses existing as like kind of two concentric circles with primary defenses in the center and a ring of secondary defenses around that, secondary defenses is where many vegans end up getting stuck without even realizing it. So we've stepped outside of primary defenses, but we're still looking at the world through the lens of carnism, through the sphere of secondary defenses. And so our advocacy and our activism is reactive rather than proactive. This means that we are buying into some of the carnistic fictions and we are reacting to its stories. Secondary defenses distort the truth, not about farmed animals and proponents of carnism. They distort the truth about vegans and vegan ideology and the vegan movement. And when we internalize these messages, when we don't recognize these stories and these defenses, we can buy into them, and then we can end up reinforcing them rather than debunking them or challenging them. And so what we really need to do is to recognize these stories so that we can rewrite them and provide truthful alternatives and be less under their influence and therefore advocate more effectively and live lives that are more grounded and empowered and sustainable for us as individuals and as activists and advocates.
One of the secondary defenses that I see occasionally is all the vegans I've ever seen are sickly. And that goes against everything I know in my reality. All the vegans I know are the epitome of health.
Well, secondary defenses, it's, you know, one thing that's important for vegans in particular to recognize are that secondary defenses and their stories, they're part of a backlash against veganism. And, you know, a backlash is a reaction of the dominant culture to threats to its power. And so vegans can get very frustrated when they see these secondary defenses, when they see the defense of, you're describing one form of projection, or the defense of secondary justification, which tells the stories that not eating animals is abnormal, unnatural, and unnecessary. But when we recognize that secondary defenses and the back, you know, because they're part of a backlash, they evolve and intensify as a movement evolves and intensifies. And we can recognize they're, in fact, a sign of the movement's success rather than its failure. This secondary defense of projection, which is what you're referring to, is a form of shooting the messenger. Projection exists to invalidate vegans and thus our message. Projection tells the story that vegans are wrong. If we shoot the messenger, we don't have to take seriously the implications of her or his message. And, you know, one projection is pathologizing of vegans, you know, the sickly vegan. And thanks to the efforts of vegan medical practitioners, for instance, and activists, this projection is quite quickly becoming a thing of the past. But it does still hold in some places, for sure.
When reading your article, I felt it was an article of empowerment and talking about stepping outside of the system. I thought there were some very simple things that would make a vegetarian or vegan feel better about themselves when they're going to dinner. For instance, when you said that, you know, you don't need to eat meat to survive. So meat eaters are actually bringing their beliefs to the dinner table. And I think for many vegans, they're worried about how people are going to feel about how they're going to eat. And, you know, they're sensitive because they think, oh, I'm the only one that's bringing my belief systems to the table. In actuality, everyone who comes to the table actually brings their own belief system. And I found that empowering because, it gives us a chance to say that we're all bringing a belief system and that we should take time to evaluate why we do believe these things and which narrative we want to believe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we do tend to assume it's only vegans and vegetarians who bring their belief systems to the dinner table, but when eating animals is not a necessity for survival, then it is a choice. And choices always stem from beliefs. We tend to think of the dominant way of being as, you know, a given, simply because most people are doing it. But just because everyone's doing it doesn't mean that it's not a matter of opinion. And that it's not biased. And so one of the stories that secondary denial tells, it denies the fact that vegans are an ideological minority group. And this is really important for vegans to recognize, and I think this is really what you're touching upon. It makes us believe that, like you said, we're the only ones with a belief system when it comes to eating animals. And it puts us often on the defensive. And what it does is it also makes us unaware of the fact that, you know, there's a lot of carnistic prejudice. So, for example, you know, I have talked to thousands of vegans around the world, and I've just heard this story over and over again where, you know, they're mocked at the dinner table or even not at the dinner table. They're, treated with some sort of hostility, you know, simply by virtue of the fact that they're vegan. Now, expressing hostility toward an individual for no reason other than his or her membership in a social group is, by definition, harassment. And so, you know, often vegans end up in this position of having to, you know, when we're being mocked, for instance, having to either laugh along with the joke and thus participate in our own degradation, or, you know, refuse to laugh along with the joke and be told that we don't have a sense of humor. Now, there are many people who eat animals that do not do this. But because the dominant culture is so internalized and it's such so organized around defenses, this is a very common experience. And for vegans to recognize that this is, it's not about them as individuals, but, you know, they are not alone, that this is a sign of a carnistic prejudice that's pervasive in the culture, and that the vast majority of people who are expressing this prejudice have no idea that they've internalized this kind of discriminatory attitude toward vegans, that can be tremendously empowering. So, you know, that's what I was saying earlier, and largely why I was motivated to write this particular article and really lay out what these secondary defenses are, what they look like, how they impact us, and how we can respond to them so that we can be more empowered and less likely to fall prey to these carnistic stories.
Yeah, it seems really difficult to get beyond these stories, and you talk about feminism and how the term feminist was actually a proud term at one time, and then it would, you know, became a slur, and how important it is in terms of taking a word and making it into something positive. And I think about Obamacare, for instance. You know, it was such a bad term for so long, and then I guess the Democratic Party realized that, and they said, well, you know, we're going to change that, and we're going to try and change the perception of Obamacare. And so they made it their own and try to make it into a positive. And I'm curious, what are your suggestions for how we move forward in changing the perception of the word vegan and all that surrounds it?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to do is to change our perception of ourselves as vegans. We need to transform our shame to pride. And this has been, you know, a requirement for activists from all social movements. You know, we have Black Pride, we have Gay Pride, and today we have Veggie Pride. And it's no coincidence that the term pride is used. one of the stories that is told by dominant cultures in general, dominant systems in general, regardless as to what system we're referring to, is that the dominant or the majority group, or the agent group, in fact, you know, that the needs of the members of the dominant group are more valid, more valuable, and more important than the needs of those of the so-called minority group. And this message can be internalized, you know. And so when vegans internalize this message, and what it's really saying to vegans is that your needs, your beliefs, your values are less important than those of the dominant culture. And so we can end up being in situations where we apologize for things that we shouldn't be apologetic for. So we apologize, for instance, for inconveniencing a host because we're asking her or him to, you know, put the cheese on the side of the salad instead of on top, and feeling like somehow this is some sort of a monumental effort. Or we're given the message that, like, not putting the butter in the mashed potatoes is so much less important when it would make such a significant difference for the vegan and be such a simple thing to do, that somehow that's less important than having a, quote-unquote, traditional meal, when we could just have easily substituted margarine if we really wanted to. And so when vegans internalize this message that their needs are less important, or that, you know, for instance, our feelings are invalid, one of the common ways that vegans are shamed is by being told that we're hypersensitive, that we're overly emotional. And again, this is a message that has been used to discredit and silence activists from a variety of social movements throughout the course of human history. When we believe in this message, then we can feel ashamed of ourselves. We can be embarrassed by our emotional reaction. We need to change that, and we need to recognize that, for instance, our emotional response of anger, grief, sadness, sometimes despair, to the atrocity that is carnism. You know, these are emotions that are normal, they're healthful, appropriate, and legitimate. When it comes to emotion around this issue, the world needs more emotion, not less.
We've been talking with Dr. Melanie Joy, psychologist, author of the book Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, and founder of the Carnism Awareness and Action Network. Melanie, would you tell our listeners where they can go to find more information about your network?
Absolutely. We're at carnism.com.
We appreciate you taking the time to be with us on the show, and keep up the good work, Melanie.
Oh, thanks. Well, you too, and it's truly my pleasure.
Barely scratched the surface of carnism on our show today, so we're having Melanie back next time on ACT Radio to discuss more about carnism. If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso website at vsep.org.
And February is Spay and Neuter Month, so don't forget to spay or neuter your pet. You can also make a donation to Pets Alive El Paso to help provide free spay and neuter services to low-income pet guardians.
You can listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio by going to ktep.org and clicking the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for joining us for Animal Concerns of Texas.